Hazel Khan. You're tuned to North Fork Works, where each month I introduce you to one of my neighbours and we hear how they live and work on the North Fork of the East End of Long Island. Today my guest is Keith Luce, North Fork native, Southold resident, international chef now returned home to build his new food and eateries venture in Greenport, Sterling Square. Welcome to North Fork Works, Keith.
Thank you for having me.
You have a very carefully thought out concept and with these four eating places in one location. And my feeling is that it's decidedly local and yet it has a sort of global feel. So could you tell us how you see that?
Well, I think the international aspect might just happen because of the life I've been fortunate enough to live. Well, I grew up on the North Fork of Long Island and left shortly after high school to make my fortune and my way in the world as a musician. I went to Manhattan and becoming a jazz musician just wasn't in the cards for many reasons. So I ended up in the restaurant business as a chef. That's my trade. And one thing led to another. I had some great mentors and my journey took all kinds of different twists, paths that I never could have expected. And I ended up working at the White House for the first Clinton administration. I was fortunate to live and work in both France and Italy. And my craft has allowed me to do a lot of traveling for work, but to experience a lot of things outside of the North Fork. When I came home, I really wanted to do something with my renewed love for the region, a region that I didn't even understand when I left. So at the Square, what we're trying to do is really create our own little culinary or food and beverage village within a village, the village of Greenport. Greenport's a special place because it's the only walking village, the only true walking village on the North Fork. It does conjure European cafes, you know, it's within a square, all the eateries or the projects that we have going in the square sort of make a square around the central path that leads to Main, the restaurant. So I had this vision of cafe tables, a place where people could find little nooks and crannies within the square and enjoy all of the bounty of the North Fork in different ways. Some of the spots are a little more casual and they're meant to be whimsical. Prep, for example, is really my take on street food.
And people can actually watch you making some
absolutely.
Of these things.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm. Also, the name prep comes from the fact that we're doing centralized prep of a lot of the local ingredients that go out to the different venues here on site and hopefully it will have a life of its own and it will be something that we send off of the North Fork, something that's made on the North Fork 100% and then sent to places like New York City and hopefully beyond.
Export, so you're in the export business.
Absolutely, we hope.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say it's got a European feel to it because there are people who've talked about Greenport as very New England. So it has this, you know, other feel to it too.
Yeah, I think the Northeast, specifically New England, it's the oldest culture that we have in the United States that you just don't find in many places. And you don't, if you were to be touched down in Greenport blindfolded, I'm not so sure you would say you were on Long Island.
I read somewhere that your family's been here since 1600. That's even before the Pilgrims came over, is that right?
That's correct. Three brothers came over from the Old World and first settled in Martha's Vineyard and then came across the Long Island Sound and touched down here on Long Island. They all took their own path. The line that I followed was a farming family. Pretty much stayed farming throughout. There was a period of time during the Depression that my grandfather did other things and rented the land out of necessity. It's a heritage I'm very proud of. And as I said earlier, I didn't know a whole lot about the region or my history. I mean, I had heard of it. My dad had made mention of it. I was fortunate to work the farm with my grandfather diversified out of potatoes. So we were doing row farming, just truck farming of different types of heritage vegetables, believe it or not. Certainly the cauliflowers and the cabbages that are so prolific out here, but we were doing things like raising tomatoes for people that came out for the summer and they would, you know, rent a certain portion of land of tomatoes and take all of the tomatoes and take them back to the city and can them.
When was that?
The 70s, mm-hmm. Which people talk about the Depression, but I think the 70s for small farmers specifically on Long Island was a really difficult time. I remember going to auction after auction of families that were losing their farms, getting out of the business. There was just a lot of turnover in the farming world at that time.
So is your father still farming?
My father, when I left the area, it was a very small farm. So I was farming along with my mother and my father. He pretty much let it go fallow. I left in 87, right after I graduated high school. So when I returned home, one of the reasons I returned home was my love of that land and remembering working it with my mother and my father and my grandfather, and all of our relatives, cousins, aunts and uncles would come every summer from the South. They had transplanted to North Carolina and Virginia and Arizona. They'd all come together and we'd work the farm together. And it was just a memory that I had that was just a beautiful memory. As I started having children, I decided I would love for them to have a connection to that land, and I would hate to see what's left of that land just be subdivided or sold off. So when I returned home, I started farming it again, cleared the land, put up some fencing to keep the deer off, mm-hmm. and I'm running some pigs there for my charcuterie program or my cured meat program that I'm doing here at the square. We also have some chickens for eggs, and this year I don't think I'm going to get as many vegetables in as I'd like. Hopefully next year we're really going to jumpstart the agricultural end of what we're trying to do.
So you'll be supplying your own vegetables and your own meats and your own eggs?
Yes.
So you are going to be your own supplier, but you also must be having to rely on other suppliers.
It's impossible to supply yourself 100% in the restaurant business. It's just such a time prohibitive business and space prohibitive. On the North Fork, I suppose I could produce enough vegetables for myself, but at what cost and at what time cost? It's a goal that I have in the back of my mind, but it's not realistic. And it's insincere because there are so many small artisan producers of great vegetables. So we support as many local producers as we can, not support, but we try to utilize their product. Well, I grew up in very humble surroundings in a great way, and I couldn't leave quickly enough. Truth be told, I wanted to leave. I knew there was something else. There are certain things in the New World, or specifically on the North Fork, that I don't love about the North Fork, but there's no place that's perfect. And what I realized was there is the opportunity to do something here because of the wineries that have been here, because of the space that has been preserved that's very special. And it's my belief that if like-minded people see that, we can save a region that was very close to being overdeveloped. Growing up on a farm, I was always driven by ingredients. And that began when I moved into New York. When I moved into the city, we would be cooking asparagus, for instance. I always use that example. We were cooking at the highest level. I was cooking at places like Le Cirque and Le Cote Basque and the Rainbow Room. The techniques were perfect. Everything was impeccable. The presentation, everything about the environment was striving towards perfection. The one thing that was different was I had better asparagus growing up because we would cut it and we'd boil it or steam it and grill it and eat it right there. So as a young man, I didn't understand why was this incredible in one way, but in another way, something was missing. And as I matured and as I began to get better at my craft, I started to realize it was the ingredients. When I ended up in Europe, it really hit home to me because we were using nothing but perfect premium ingredients that were in season from the region. And I said, oh, that's what it is. That's really ultimately what the difference is. And that's when I began to start to think about coming home and figuring out when that time would be right, because the region has all of these things to offer. If you're a chef and you don't pay attention to your ingredients and you're not driven by your region, then you're not putting the best food on the table that you can. So any place I've been, I've taken inspiration from the region. However, I worked the soil here from a very early age. I remember driving the tractor for my parents when I was 5 years old so they could plant. That's how small of a farm it was. When you know a place that intimately, I think it really gives you an edge as a chef, and I think it ties you to that place.
You know, there's the whole locavore food movement.
Yes.
You're exemplifying it without maybe being an official part of it? Or do you, I mean, because there are certain criteria that this locavore movement espouses, I suppose. How do you feel about that?
I've always practiced that way of cooking and being. I require it. And I think at this point it becomes I think it's self-evident. I think that you shouldn't have to say that's what you do. I think it should just be done. And when things are defined, I think the problem with our world right now, and I don't want to get too political, is when something becomes marketed to the point that it is, it bothers me. I just want to be Keith, a chef from North Fork of Long Island, that is putting something great out there that anyone can enjoy. And my belief is you put something out there and the proof is in the pudding. And then, you know, by talking with the farmers that are producing your food, by utilizing their products, by walking the fields with them, by talking with the fishermen and actually interacting with those producers, you are practicing a locavore tradition on a level that very few people do. And I think that those producers not only appreciate it, but they're telling the people that are going to them for their ingredients, the places that are buying their ingredients. And that's sustainability and building a community, in my belief. I've always been somebody that does not take the easy way. When I was younger, I was very set in my, well, not set in my ways, but idealistic. And I would, if something wasn't in season, for instance, it wouldn't be on my menu. And this is, you know, in the early 90s in Chicago, right? So how many people are going to a restaurant for root vegetables only? You know, now, as you mature, you start to understand, and I'm getting to the sustainability issue, you start to understand, well, if anything's ever really going to take root in this world, and we live in a marketing world, if somebody grabs hold of a term like sustainability, if the media does, and makes it something else, and then suddenly, and the time isn't that far off, that McDonald's is going to have something that is sustainable or sustainably raised. All of the franchises are going to find a way to utilize the term sustainable. Then where does that leave us? And is that sustainable? No, I don't believe it is. So I think as I've matured, I think of sustainability differently. I think sustainability is first and foremost staying in business. That's the very definition of sustainability. You've sustained a business. And if your belief system is one way, then you're working towards that end goal. And there are certain things that I do here that I never would have done in my career prior. You know, our oyster program, for instance. I'm bringing oysters in from all over the country because they're all sustainably raised. I know all of the producers of all the oysters that I'm bringing in because I've lived in all of these places. Or if I haven't lived there, I know people that are vouching for that product. I'm bringing sustainably raised shellfish to the North Fork of Long Island and creating an oyster program that allows people to interface and interact with seafood in a way that I don't think anyone, certainly out this far east, has ever done. So you can sit down and you can taste through all five species of oysters. Now, when I was younger and more idealistic, I wouldn't have flown things in because I would have said, well, that's not regional, that's not sustainable.
Because, yeah, the locavore movement would then say, right, you're not being locavore-ish enough. Because you're bringing it from more than 100 miles or whatever,
right,
and you're using carbon footprints and all that stuff.
Right. Which is true, but honestly, I think if these things are done responsibly, you can't, in order to move forward in the world, you also have to recognize that there is technology that wasn't around, and that plane is going to be flying from the Pacific Northwest here anyway.
Well, the main thing is also that you're conscious of what you're doing.
Yes.
I mean,
absolutely.
Consciousness and intention do count.
Yes.
Even if you are using fossil fuels.
Yes.
Keith Luce is talking about his life and work as a restaurateur on the North Fork. This is Hazel Khan on WPKN Radio. Just by doing business with other sustainable growers of whatever it is that they're growing, you're selling New York wines.
I'm a chef, so most of the businesses that I've done have been very driven from the kitchen. And all of the projects that we have going here are that way. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of great wineries now on the North Fork of Long Island. There are a lot of great craft distilled items and craft beers that are available now on Long Island and in New York State. Now, going back to the sustainability discussion, you can drive up and down the wine route and you can taste wines at any one of a number of great wineries. But we don't recognize the Finger Lakes, for instance, on Long Island the way I think we should, and I think vice versa. my time in Napa and Sonoma, and to a certain extent in wine producing regions in Europe, the one thing that I really loved was people were local centric, but you also recognize what's happening around you. So the tasting room, what I'm trying to do is we're going to feature a local winery every month, but most of the other things that are available to taste there, just like the oyster program, are going to be from New York State. So there's a comparison. I use the word discussion. I think that brings a discussion forward, and I think it creates an environment where everybody wins. Because if you only look at your small region, it's tunnel vision.
You don't have context.
There's no growth. I'm not interested in that anymore. You know, I love this region, and I'll do anything I can to make sure that I support or I'm a part of the whole locavore movement here. But I think part of the problem is it's become, in a short time, it's become a little myopic. And I think we need to think outside of this region to make it the region that it can become. But in order to really have an experience and become a part of something, I think you have to go to a place where you can taste things side by side or experience things side by side. And it's not just one singular view of a topic. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, you use the word journeyman, and I was thinking of the word apprentice.
Totally.
You know, those kinds of things, rather than just suddenly become an expert because you've gone to wine.com or whatever.
Right. The world is full of experts right now.
Really. But let me ask you something else. This American notion, how does that fit into what you were saying?
What does American mean? And I think that's, you have to ask that first. And I've asked myself that question for a very long time. When I left the restaurants that I worked in New York and in Europe, everything I had done to that point, even the things in my own country, were French. Mm. I love French cuisine. I love the standards that were put in place by French masters. I think it's such a great starting point. You can say the same thing for Japan, Mexico, Italy, India. It goes on and on. There are the building blocks or the foundations of any topic, but certainly cookery, being a chef. So when I left those kitchens, I came back to the United States. I was working at the White House. I hung, for the first time in my life, a map of the United States, of North America, on my wall to remind me I was in the United States. I didn't want to be replicating another nation's cuisine. I wanted to be producing American cuisine. And there were a lot of people during that period of time in the 80s that were trying to do that. So I am trying to take some of those nostalgic dishes and give them my own little twist. Macaroni and cheese, and I think we talked about this, but the macaroni, we're extruding ourselves. We're making the macaroni. You know, I think there are ways to take dishes that people think are lowbrow and sort of take them to a higher level. I mean, we're not opening packages of Kraft macaroni and cheese. We're taking ingredients that are local whenever possible. We're handcrafting them and we're delivering them to people. And there are people that come through the doors and look at the menu and say, there's nothing I can find to eat. And that's a challenge because you say, well, no, you don't understand. It's not macaroni and cheese. It is, but it's not.
I just wonder, what do you think it is that they're looking for when they want this kind of food, American local food or American food or any of those things? What is it that they're getting from it?
I can tell you my perspective of it. I think we have become so bombarded by information, especially people maybe of my generation who were one of the last generations that we had computers, but we remember a time when we didn't have computers. My generation went from, as the generations before me, went from black and white TV to handheld computers, right, in 30 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, I think there's sensory overload, and I think people from that generation are thinking, wow, it was so much more simpler. It's great to be in the world now. There are so many great things, but we're missing something. And I think as you mature, you want to leave something behind. And I think quality of life is something that those generations are thinking of. And I think it's what's driving us back to that nostalgia. I think it's why people want that. It's something that's comfortable instead of having computer-generated images bombarding you or eating in a theme restaurant where it has nothing to do with quality or integrity. It's just about feeding the masses garbage. And we're learning about all of the things that have been put out there by, I hate to say it, our government and large corporations in the food industry that are so bad for us, and all the diseases that are there. I think people are fed up with those sorts of things, and they want to know. They want to know why, and they want to return to a place where
they can trust.
They can trust, and they can eat an apple, and they can know it's an apple. And it's going to taste the way that they tasted an apple when they were 10 years old.
So even if they're not even clear that they're looking for that, when they see it, they recognize it.
I think that's true.
Yeah. I was just wondering if there are things that we're eating today, or that you are preparing today, or ingredients from today, that maybe people in your family history did 200 or 300 years ago.
There are things that slowly but surely I hope to add to what we're doing here at the Square. But I think when you start taking that idea of historic food and putting it on a menu, going back to our discussion about sustainability, it's a business. So if you get too esoteric, people don't get it. So we have a succotash, for instance, on the menu. It's our own little take on a succotash. That was a native dish. And it was really seasonal, you know, seasonal staples, vegetables that were brought together to form a complete protein for sustenance. And that's what we're doing. Now, again, we're not here to preach to people. We're here to make people happy. So that's one small thing. I think we've lost our way a little bit. So I think to go back, we also have to look at where we are in the world now and find our way back.
So in a way, I guess the way I should have asked, or could have asked the question, is what are the things they used to eat that we would never eat now, like raccoon stew or sort of venison? And would you, I mean, you could shoot deer here and have local deer. We do a community service. And would you ever do anything like that?
Well, it's a problem. It's a problem out here.
The deer.
Yeah, and there's a solution.
Venison is the solution to deer.
Absolutely, but our government stands in the way of that. We can't serve. I would love to be able to serve local venison.
You wouldn't be able to.
You're unable because it's not processed in a USDA facility. So we have this problem. We have a way of disposing of them in a way that is, dare I say, sustainable, right? Everybody wins, but we're unable to do that because there's something in the middle that is stopping us from
that. The regulations.
Absolutely.
Those are federal regulations.
Are federal regulations. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't want just anybody killing a deer and bringing tainted meat in. I understand that. But there are ways around that. And certainly, there are native indigenous ingredients that are difficult on a commercial level to use because of those regulations. And I hope to see a time in my lifetime where that isn't the case. We've become wasteful beings. Mm-hmm. Raccoon stew, I've tasted raccoon. I'm not so sure. Could I create something that people would like? I'm pretty sure I could, but is that something that people want? No. I mean, we live in a time of privilege when the difference between necessity and sustenance, right? We've evolved a little bit. So we don't have to go out and trap a raccoon to exist through a long winter. So,
well, not yet. Anyway.
Not yet. You never know.
So when things are out of season, then you will just import them.
Again, going back to sustainability, yeah. I've learned that you have to push the seasons a little bit because there are people, the minute they see a strawberry on any menu, they're wondering why you don't have a strawberry. As a business owner, you have to take heed in that. I don't think we live in a place that has enough traffic. I'm very particular, but I think sustainability, again, means staying in business. So I don't like to import things. I won't be importing products in February that are clearly out of season, but I might bring something in from Georgia.
Just, you might bring Georgia peaches before the season would start here, stretching
yes,
the season.
Yes, and I think, you know, when I said earlier, I alluded to, I do things that I never would have done. Well, you know, sustainability, making sure you're in business.
Because the other question I had about good products, what about that? I mean, sustainability is expensive.
It is.
So does that mean it's really for the elites?
If there's something I'm proud of or adamant about what I'm trying to do here, is that I don't think it should be. And I think that goes back to the conversation about the media handling something and it becoming something that it was never meant to be. I think the minute you put a label, we're not going to get into the organic discussion, but the minute you classify something, suddenly there are added costs to that producer because they have to follow certain agendas and they have to do things a specific way, which adds cost, which then adds a cachet. And they do it because they think generally people that certify things are thinking of what that will do for their business. So then they jack their prices up. I mean, not everybody, but that happens. Something that I learned a long time ago, if you can meet the producer of your product and look them in the eye and you know what type of person they are and they can tell you about what they're doing, it doesn't matter what classification they have because you know what they're producing is something that you want to consume. And I believe that. You might believe that that certification makes you safer than any other vegetable that you're eating by eating
you
that
as
vegetable.
As the consumer.
As a consumer, one might believe, and that's fine. The environment is a primary concern of mine. But again, I think if there's somebody that is working in their own field and has a handle on what is happening on their farm or on their boat, I think anybody that does something like farm or fish has a healthy respect for their environment. We're not talking about people that are doing large tract farming here on Long Island. We're talking about people that roll up their sleeves. And there are, you know, there are some people that use heavy, heavy chemicals. You don't have to go that way. It's an old way of looking at farming. It's what the government presented after World War II. The government was looking at producing a perfect food source for a perfect working society. Less people on the farms producing things and more people producing infrastructure and making this a great empire. People were in labs working during World War II, creating all these chemicals. Oh, well, you can get rid of pests this way. Five people can farm 2,000 acres of land, which means this much wheat and corn, which means this much food storage for this much. And
efficiency.
Right.
Efficiency.
And it really, that's where the GMOs came in. We're not really dealing with that here on Long Island right now. And let's hope we never are.
But are you generally pessimistic or optimistic about these things?
I wouldn't be doing this. I work really hard, and I think at this point in my life, I probably don't have to be working this hard, but I couldn't live with myself if I weren't working this hard because I truly believe that this is a special place. I think this is a special village, and I think we're on the verge of doing something that is going to be remembered as very special. I think intentions need to come from a pure place.
Thank you very much, Keith.
Thank you.
You heard Keith Luce, restaurateur, chef, North Fork native, and South Hold resident, speaking to Hazel Kahn on North Fork Works on WPKN Radio. North Fork Works airs on the first Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. and is produced by Tony Ernst. Podcasts of North Fork Works programs are archived on hazelkahn.com.